Hello and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Consider this. Alzheimer's disease affects 1 in 10 Americans over age 65, or 5.5 million people. American adults age 18 and up with any form of mental illness in a given year is said to affect 1 in 5 people, or 43.4 million. According to the National Institutes of Health, $1.3 billion was spent on Alzheimer's disease in 2015, compared to $919 million for anxiety and bipolar disorders, depression, schizophrenia, and suicide combined. Those statistics illustrate what mental health professionals know. Mental and physical illness are not regarded in the same way. Mental Health America CEO Paul Gianfrido is in Hawaii to help Mental Health America of Hawaii mark its 75th anniversary, and he joins us in our studio now. Aloha. Welcome.
Thank you.
Nice to have you here. When you hear statistics like we just talked about a moment ago, this certainly is something that you live with all the time. In your experience very recently, having been on the Hill and talking in a bipartisan way to lawmakers, what has been their reaction when you've tried to convince them that, well, mental health needs funding too?
Well, it's been a very hard sell over the course of the last several generations, really. Ever since we moved people from state psychiatric hospitals out onto our streets and really failed to develop community-based systems of care, services, and supports for people, we've really had a very different model for looking at mental illnesses. It's been a public safety model, not a public health model, because we, as a matter of public policy, have applied this danger to self or others standard as a trigger to treatment, which is a non-clinical standard. It's made mental illnesses the only chronic diseases in America that we've waited until stage four to treat, and then often inappropriately only through incarceration. Really, it's only been in the last couple of years, I think, that policymakers have begun to understand we can't keep loading our jails and prisons up with nonviolent offenders who just happen to have a behavioral illness. We've got to not waste that money and really invest it differently. And I think we're beginning to turn a corner now.
When you talk about stage four, I can imagine people thinking, well, you know, if somebody were stage four cancer or they were stage four fill in the blank, this would not be a way of approaching a particular disease. We talk a great deal about prevention when it comes to heart disease or cancer and fill in the blank. We don't tend to do that about mental illness as much, and you make the point that we try to intercede only when we're at that stage four level. Are you seeing any progress away from that in terms of how this is being positioned to lawmakers from your organization and others?
Yeah, well, at Mental Health America, we stand for four things. We say prevention for all, early identification and intervention for those at risk, integrated health, behavioral health, and other services for those who need them, with recovery as the goal. And when we look at mental illnesses, what a lot of people don't understand is that these are diseases of childhood. Half of all mental illnesses emerge by the age of 14, three-quarters by the age of 25. If we're going to do better earlier intervention, we have to start with our kids, and we have to start with our kids in schools. And I am seeing a difference in understanding on the part of people about the importance of this early intervention. We have an online screening program at Mental Health America. People can go and anonymously screen for a variety of common mental illnesses using evidence-based screening tools, just mhascreening.org. In the last 3 years, 2.25 million people have used these screening tools, and most of them are under the age of 25. And what we're discovering is three-quarters of them screen as positive or moderate to severe for the conditions for which they screen. Three-quarters of those tell us they've never been diagnosed with anything before. So when you notice this, you realize it really is like doing early identification for cancer. The way we bent the death rates for cancers, for heart disease, and for other chronic conditions wasn't with better stage four interventions. It was with better prevention, better early identification. And right now, it's recommended that everybody over the age of 11 have at least an annual mental health screening, just like they have kids screenings for vision, and just like adults have screening for blood pressure.
To a lot of parents, that's going to sound really difficult to swallow. What, you want me to take my kid to have, sit down and talk to a therapist? that bespeaks the whole idea of a stigma that's still attached to mental illness, and that we don't regard it with the parity that we do physical illness and taking care of body, mind, and spirit. Although we talk a good game about that when it's appropriate, how do you continue to fade that stigma and normalize this idea of taking care of body and mind and spirit, when especially you're talking about kids, 11 and up?
Well, that's right. I think that the most important thing we can do is to tell our stories, because narratives matter. And I tell mine. My son is 32 years old, been living with schizophrenia for the last 25-plus years right now. And while it may have been a scary thing if he were to have gotten that diagnosis when he was 5 or 6 years old, when the symptoms first began to show themselves, he would have been a whole lot better off, and we would have been a whole lot better off if he'd gotten the right diagnosis at that time. So I understand that parents are often afraid about this, but I think it's because they equate this with potential for danger to self or potential for danger to others, and really don't think that recovery is possible, much less likely. And I think what we're learning is that that's not the case. If you do early identification, then recovery becomes increasingly likely. And the bad things that happen to people like my son Tim, homelessness, hospitalization, incarceration later on, those things we can avoid.
How is your son doing now?
Tim's doing pretty well. He's 32 years old. He's been trying to get in off the streets. He lives in San Francisco independently, getting some support and, looking forward to life, still with an optimistic and patient view about life. And, you know, what can any parent hope for but that their child would be like that? Yeah.
As your organization is now working in concert with other organizations, including NAMI, including so many others who are involved with mental illness, is this something that you see as being the way of the future, to be able to make serious inroads with Congress and to make them understand the necessity for being able to treat mental illness and, say, substance abuse at the same time?
Yeah, one of the reasons why the National Mental Health Advocacy Organizations, Mental Health America, NAMI, both APAs and others, I think were less effective up until the last couple years is because they were often at odds with one another. And members of Congress, I used to be a state policymaker, a member of my state legislature myself, and we always knew, like the members of Congress, that if the advocates didn't agree among themselves, that we could kind of wait that out and, you know, figure out what the consensus that was going to emerge would be. And starting a couple years ago, we just gathered together the other major advocacy organizations and said, let's all go do some visits together to members of Congress. And we went together and we said, look, we don't always agree on every detail, but what we all agree about is it's critical that we have legislation now. And if you guys are willing to compromise, we're willing to compromise. So you're not going to use us to hold you up. As a result of that, we got some really good stuff into the 21st Century Cures Act, the last act that was signed into law by President Obama before he left office. A lot of good mental health provisions. Now we got to get the funding, but at least we laid a foundation for the kind of system that we should have had for the last 30 years.
When you talk about funding, that also brings up Medicaid issues of Medicaid cutbacks if those who are expanded under the ACA, in fact, now are changed. Yes, there is time on this because the Senate's going to craft their own legislation, and we'll see what happens. But as you're looking into a deeper future, not just the very immediate future, what is it that you think that lawmakers, both at the state level and clearly federally, need to understand in charting a course forward, given those stunning statistics that you told us a little earlier about the emergence of mental health at such an early age, or at least the signs being there?
Yeah, one of the things that they need to understand is that somewhere around 30% of the people who have benefited from the Medicaid expansion are people with behavioral illnesses. And those are adults. Those are people like my son, Tim, who benefit from that kind of an expansion, and people who are frankly a little better off than Tim. So people need to understand that that expansion meant something to people, particularly people with serious mental illnesses who've had them a long time. But it also means a lot. The Medicaid program and others mean a lot to kids, and people need to recognize this. So we have good consensus in Congress, both members of both parties, members of both chambers, who really, I think, have emerged as supporters for mental health. But we really need them to put their money where their mouth is.
Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Paul Gianfrillo is the president and CEO of Mental Health America, headquartered in Alexandria, Virginia. He's worked in a variety of health and mental health-related positions during a career spanning over 30 years. As he mentioned, he's been a legislator, consultant, speaker, and writer. His book is Losing Tim, How Our Health and Education Systems Failed My Son with Schizophrenia. He's visiting Hawaii for the first time to celebrate Mental Health America of Hawaii's 75th anniversary.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, a classic Broadway score and a chamber music presentation. But first, your quiz.
For today's backyard quiz, we're in full bloom. We're thinking about a certain tree that you probably wouldn't notice most of the year. When it's not flush with flower, this tree is either bare or covered in green fern-like leaves. But for a few weeks every spring, these trees erupt with vibrant violet color flowers found on the tip of each branch, some 40 to 90 of them. Although it's not native to Hawaii, this tree was introduced to the islands in 1900 from South America. The tree is especially prominent in upcountry Maui on the slopes of Haleakala, and that's enough of a hint. If you've got the answer, you can give us a call at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689, and the first caller to get it right gets the prize.
Aloha, I'm Luther Dickinson from the North Mississippi All-Stars, and you're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Broadway show West Side Story changed the musical forever with innovative music, choreography, and subject matter as a collaboration among historic talents. Leonard Bernstein's music manages to be both contemporary, as it flirts with the harmonies and melodies of the 20th century modernist, and accessible with songs that instantly became part of the canon. The music of West Side Story is more than strong enough to be presented in a concert format, which is what the Maui Chamber Orchestra is doing this weekend. Conductor Robert Willis is putting the program together, and he's with us by phone. Hi, how are you?
Hi, Chris. Doing well. Thank you. How are you?
Thanks for talking with us. You know, if you just looked at the music of this, you might think it was a pretty daring modern composition, don't you think?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The more I get into this score and the more the orchestra plays it, the more things we discover, and it's a marvelous piece of music.
And you know, you would think that in a popular culture event like this, a Broadway show, you wouldn't find, frequently it flirts with dissonance and harmonies that you really wouldn't expect in classic Broadway musicals.
That's true, but all of those little dissonances and blasts and vibrations all serve to advance the storyline through the notes of the music. So it's quite something.
Well, how do those little hints of dissonance, you know, sort of like garlic, how does it change the nature of the story being told?
Well, for example, you have almost the conclusion of the first act. The conclusion of the first act is the rumble, which is instrumental. But the piece right before that is a piece called Tonight, and it brings in the Sharks with one theme of music, the Jets with another theme of music, Anita with another, Tony and Maria with yet another. And all these four or five parties are converging at the same time. And so it's an amalgamation of all these various themes that are going on, and there's going to be dissonances because the Sharks and the Jets are going to be fighting one another.
Yeah.
And it's absolutely terrific.
Well, that's kind of how it's used, isn't it, to connote danger, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's several musical tension moments in the piece. And in discussing this with the rights holders in New York, they asked me, they said, well, what are you going to do when there's a rumble scene? Are you going to have the actors on stage doing their choreography? And I said, no. And I said, I would submit to you that if you just listen to the music itself, you will hear the fighting in the music.
Yeah.
That's what we're doing.
Well, that's and you're doing it. You're doing the music chronologically, I assume.
Absolutely. Right in order from beginning to end.
Yeah. Yeah. So that you have that, and you know, this, as you said, very sophisticated compositional, use of motifs, recurrent motifs, foreshadowing by having a little bit of a hint of what's to come.
Absolutely. So
a lot of craft in there, isn't there?
Yes, and the orchestration is, again, another phase of this that's absolutely marvelous. There's seven separate violin parts, so we have 14 violins on this. There are four percussion players playing 38 percussion instruments, five reed players playing 28 reed instruments.
Wow.
So it's an absolute marvelous thing, marvelous.
Which kind of shows what your task has been, Robert, in terms of taking something that on the surface is well-known, hummable melodies and things like that, and finding an awful lot of complexity when you delve deep.
Well, it's complex enough if you just try to play it on the piano. But if you try to play it with a 40-piece orchestra, which is what we're going to have, a 40-piece orchestra doing this piece, it's just a whole completely different experience to hear it like this. If you go hear West Side Story at a local high school or a local college, you're certainly not going to be able to hear it with a 40-piece orchestra. So
yeah.
This is a unique event that we're going to be able to do.
Even in a Broadway theater, you're not going to hear 40 pieces playing it.
No, you're not. You're going to hear about 20, and it's going to be in a hall that seats 6,000. Our hall seats 400. And so you talk about being in the middle of the music. You're going to be right in the center of it.
That's a lot of work, isn't it?
Yes. Yes, it has been, but it's a labor of love. We're starting a series that we're going to be doing every year called Musicals in Concert, and it's basically what we're going to do is we're going to take a musical and do it in concert form, and usually a musical that is not produced for many other reasons, such as cost or accessibility or whatever, but we can do it in a concert setting. So we're going to start doing this on an annual basis. This is going to be part of what we do.
I'm trying to think of what others might be, candidates for that kind of presentation.
Well, for example, nobody does My Fair Lady because the costume budget will bankrupt most theater companies.
Oh, yeah.
But yet the music, I mean, you should hear this music. There's a whole bunch of kids that have never heard it. Nobody does Ragtime. Nobody does The Secret Garden. Nobody does Light in the Piazza. There's a whole bunch of musicals that you could do that are not done. When was the last time you heard Kismet? So we can do them in concert.
No, that's a really good way because, the vagaries of Broadway are such that a lot of great shows close for one reason or another and then are discovered only in revival, yeah?
That's correct.
I mean, that's obviously...
But why can't we do them just with the music and do them in an in-concert setting? Don't do the choreography, don't do the sets, don't do the props, but let's do the music and let's do them with actors in character, in costume, but yet without a lot of the other production elements and do a concert performance.
So you have your singers are performing as actors as well?
Correct. Absolutely.
So
I mean, you really can't sing a song and not act it at the same time. You have to.
No, that's quite right. And so that really gives you a very solid, that really tells the story.
People will walk out of this not only having the musical experience, but they'll walk out of this having the story experience as well.
At the time this show was produced, it was a pretty radical idea to take a Romeo and Juliet in a gang setting. You know, this is not the glamorous people musical audiences had expected.
Well, just that you would take Romeo and Juliet and do an adaptation of it, number one.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, that you would do a musical adaptation of it. And then thirdly, that you would put it in New York with rival gangs. And then the music has so many jazz elements to it. It's just, it's wow. I mean, it's really a wow moment.
Yeah.
So it's iconic. It's iconic. And the interesting part about it is it came out in September 1957. So this is the 60th anniversary of the work this year, 2017.
You could easily persuade most audiences that it had been written last week, couldn't you?
Absolutely. Well, especially certain numbers, such as the number called Cool. The middle of that number, you'd swear that was a jazz piece that was written last week.
Yeah, no kidding. Thanks so much for talking with us. It really sounds like a great show.
Thanks, Chris. We're going to have a lot of fun. We have just a couple tickets left for Sunday and a little bit more left for Saturday, but I think it's going to sell out pretty well.
Sounds like it. Thanks a lot. Robert Wills is the conductor of the Maui Chamber Orchestra, which is presenting West Side Story in concert format this Saturday evening and Sunday afternoon at the Iao Theater in Wailuku.
Foster parents thought they'd be getting additional funds in a settlement they thought was all wrapped up with the state, until the House said no. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has the reality check. Hi, Chad.
Hello, Beth Ann.
So, I mean, I remember with this case and
sure.
Well, the two lawsuits and talking to one of the women who is involved with it, and she was overjoyed last August when it seemed that they were going to be getting additional funds to take care of foster kids because costs are escalating. What happened?
Well, that's something we can't seem to get straight answers on. And by the way, that settlement was $85 million involving not only some back payments to some of those foster care parents over the years, but also money going forward, an adjustment and how much they get every month when they take care of a kid, bring them into their home. The House of Representatives, the leadership, and that would be Speaker Scott Psyche and Sylvia Luke, chair of the Finance Committee, appear to be the ones that did this because they're the ones that make the call on what goes into the budget and related legislation. And it appeared that there was a deal for $14 million to go to the Department of Human Services, which administers the foster care program. And then there was another $3.4 million for the settlement, legal fees and some back payments. It was all set to go. The governor wanted it. The attorney general, Doug Chin, wanted it. DHS agreed to it. Even the Senate was ready to sign off of it. And then the House decided not to. And so that money did not go through. And this all happened in the last days of the legislature. The House will not tell us why, other than Psyche saying on the record that he thought the attorney fees were just too much money, about $1.1 million, actually.
Oh, okay, but now if this is going to go back to court,
right.
Doesn't that mean increased in attorney's fees and maybe even an increased settlement?
There's talk that it could be in the hundreds of millions of dollars. That's coming from Paul Alston. His law firm is part of this class action lawsuit. Gavin Thornton with the Hawaii Appleseed Center as well, saying, you know, when you have a deal that's worked out, and by the way, those lawyers' fees were actually brought down. It was more like $2.9 million. They settled for $1.1. But they're saying, Thornton as well as Paul Alston, that, boy, you're looking at maybe doubling or more the cost because you had something worked out and it fell through. And think about just compounding that with foster parents still getting lower payments going forward, potential legal action coming. Who knows? It could take years to solve this.
And meanwhile, you're right. These parents are going to be caring for kids and many of them having to do it out of their own pockets because clearly getting $503 a month or something nearabouts is not enough to take care of a kid.
Yeah, 529. They upped it a little bit, 600 here and there. But actually, there was an estimate with inflation. It should be more like $970, quite a bit more. By the way, one of those foster mothers who's been doing it for 24 years, she said, you know what I want? I want each legislator to take a foster kid under their wing for a whole week and see how much it costs them. And then maybe they'll come forward and step up to the plate and give us the money that we need.
That sounds like Raynette Achong. We talked
about that. That is, in fact, Raynette. Yes, that's correct.
All right. Well, I don't know that any lawmaker is going to take her up on that offer.
Probably not.
Point well made, and we'll see what happens and hopefully see how this plays out in a favorable way for foster kids especially. Thanks very much, Chad.
Thanks, Beth Ann.
Every day we bring you a reality check from Civil Beat, today featuring reporter Chad Blair. Oahu's mumps outbreak added 3 more cases yesterday. They will likely not be the last. Just like the flu, mumps is a respiratory disease spread when an infected person coughs or sneezes, and that's exactly why it's so difficult to trace. That leaves a lot to conjecture about how mumps is back in our state and how the current 42 cases might well grow. Earlier today, I spoke with state epidemiologist Dr. Sarah Park, who sees little pattern in how the disease may spread.
Respiratory diseases are always frustrating because just by the way they're transmitted human to human, you can imagine. I mean, think about our regular flu season. You know, we can't connect any cases really outside of a family, and hearsay. So imagine this, at least on this, on our side here, mumps is a highly unusual infection. You know, we don't normally have it, within the state. We're not endemic for mumps. The U.S. in general is not endemic for mumps. So we know that if you have a locally acquired case, it's just going to be an unusual presentation. And, we're talking about a respiratory disease, essentially. So transmitted human to human, that's the challenging part, from people coughing and sneezing. So, unfortunately, if you're sick and you drag yourself into work or school or you go shopping or go to a potluck or go to church, that just makes, our job and the job of trying to protect the community that much harder, trying to track things down, because we have to look at every place you could have been while you were infectious.
But that makes this all the more interesting to talk about in light of people perhaps who have decided not to get vaccinations. I mean, when kids are small, they usually get measles, mumps, rubella. But we've seen a backlash over successive decades of people who just don't want to do vaccinations for whatever reason.
Right.
Is there any reason to indicate that this might be some of what we're seeing?
It's hard to say. That would be a lot of speculation. I think that if anything, it's just a reminder of why we do vaccinate, that these diseases are highly contagious. While this disease may not cause as many severe cases, fortunately, many of the cases have been able to convalesce or get better at home. It still is a potentially serious disease, can potentially have some complications, such as sterility for males and females. The more severe sort of complications can be pneumonia or encephalitis or brain inflammation, essentially. Fortunately, those severe complications are rare, but we have to think about that, especially in our community. The older you are when you're infected, the more likely you're at risk for the severe complications. There are growing numbers of people who have problems with their immune system because, we're able to help folks, cancer treatments, for instance, et cetera. So these people are at increased risk, and it's the community effort is, it's not just about protecting yourself, it's about protecting our families, our communities as well. And so it's a really good sort of a wake-up call as to why we do vaccinate. The vaccines, for mumps, the mumps component, while it may not be 100% effective, it's pretty effective. I mean, if you just think about, you know, a lot of people have been asking about, well, there are these kids in schools that are getting it and they're vaccinated. Well, look at it this way. You know, look at a school, one of the schools I can think of, 100% of the kids, and kudos to those parents, by the way, 100% of those kids are vaccinated. And, yeah, we had, you know, a couple of kids in that school who came down with mumps, unfortunately. But, you know, it could have been a lot worse. If the vaccine didn't work, or, God forbid, half the school weren't vaccinated, we'd be seeing tens, 20, maybe 100 cases of mumps all at once, just from that one school, not the one or two cases. So if anything, people should take heart in knowing that the vaccine does work. It's not 100%, but it's pretty effective, if you ask me. Just seeing how quickly something like this can spread in the community because it is a respiratory disease. Unfortunately, we continue to keep recommending to people stay home from work and school. And I think a lot of folks might privately admit that they've sometimes still gone out while they're sick, but protect the community, protect their family and friends from their illness by not encouraging them to be outside or allowing for that to be out and about. Because every one of us can think about a sick person who came into work, or, you know, we know about a child who went to school, and pretty soon everyone was, you know, sick. You know, just that's just how it spreads.
The last time that we had an outbreak 16 years ago, compared to this one, are there any similarities? Is there anything that you can draw from it about why we saw it happen?
No, unfortunately, I can't. And I would preface to say that I wasn't here 16 years ago, so I don't know all the details of that particular time. But I can say that for this outbreak, the only thing I can say is that we know is probably introduced by someone who traveled somewhere. Unfortunately, right now, there are so many outbreaks and clusters going on the mainland as well as internationally that it really requires that all of us are vigilant when we travel. This is why it's important to assure you have all your vaccinations, even your routine ones, not just the travel vaccines, that you're careful about monitoring yourself when you come home from such travel, even if it's, you know, you think, oh, it's just to Washington State or to California. You know, it's not a big deal. What kind of infections could I possibly bring up, you know, bring home? Well, you just never know. I mean, and so it's no matter where you travel, even to another island, I think it's important to just be cognizant of, you know, what it is, you know, taking care of yourself and then taking care of protecting others when you get home. So I think that's probably, given that we know it's not endemic here, that's the most likely scenario as to how it was introduced. But who introduced it from where, I'm really doubting we'll ever be able to determine that. It's also possible that what we're actually looking at is a couple of introductions, and that what we're seeing now are commonalities among a few of the cases that are linking them up. And perhaps it's just that, you know, there's some common travel to certain areas where there are outbreaks occurring right now.
There's this case on Kauai, which seems to be the outlier,
right,
and a little strange.
It's strange and it's concerning for a couple of reasons. If it truly represents a connection to Oahu, that's obviously a concern, because it means that someone was traveling while they're potentially infectious, and they potentially could have infected more than this one person. You know, this one person, fortunately, sounds like from our investigation, did all the right things as soon as they were ill, and even before they were ill, they basically stayed at home and didn't go to work, so kudos to that person. But, you know, we don't know for certain, you know, whether anyone else would have been infected by whoever infected this person. You know, so we're monitoring very closely. It's why we sent out a medical advisory again to remind physicians, not just in Kauai, not just on Oahu, but on all islands, to be cognizant, aware. There's always a potential, people are constantly traveling, that, you know, it could be introduced anywhere else. The other concerning thing is that it, again, is a reminder, if it's not a connection to Oahu and it's a connection to something else, that we are connected to many other places. You know, many of our residents, many of us travel. We get many visitors from so many places, and as I've already mentioned, there are outbreaks even now in other states. I get public health alerts about them. So I know there's activity going on in other states as well as internationally, and we just have to be mindful. As we can see with what's going on in Oahu, it's very contagious, and you know, it takes the entire community coming together to try and protect ourselves.
Sarah, we're going to go in just a second, but I just wanted to ask you, your gut sense of this is that we may see other cases?
We may very well see other cases just based on our current investigation, some of the findings. As I said, we have continued concerns because some cases, unfortunately, weren't as good as the individual on Kauai about keeping themselves isolated. And so we're following through and trying to identify contacts. But it's difficult, as you can imagine. You know, with a foodborne investigation, it's hard because hard enough, you know, trying to get people to remember what they ate. But a little bit easier, I would say, compared with a respiratory disease investigation where you're trying to get them to remember everywhere they were and, you know, potentially who they were in contact with. You know, if they went to a store, they're not going to know which store clerk that they talked to, you know, and for example. And so these kind of things, you know, make it more challenging in terms of trying to, you know, determine, you know, who potentially may be at risk. And it doesn't help also sometimes, unfortunately, some cases may not be quite so willing, let's say, to help us out here and help the community out and answer our questions. They may be a little difficult, and that makes it that much harder. So we're unfortunately looking at potentially more cases before this burns out, but I'm hopeful with your help, if we can get the word out for the community to understand, this is a time we all come together, which means we look at our vaccination records, our children's vaccination records, we assure that we're immune, you know, that we follow recommendations, the prevention messages in terms of, you know, if you're sick, staying home, and if at all possible, figure out something else to do instead of, if you need to be productive for work, talk with your employer, colleagues, try to figure something else out for school. You know, in some ways, thank goodness school will be out. So, you know, hopefully kids won't be in those congregated settings. But it also means making sure if they are sick, they're not out and about playing or in the mall either, because that's not helpful. So everyone coming together, think about how can we all do our part to, you know, stop this transmission of this disease.
Well, thank you very much for the time today.
Sure. Thank you.
Dr. Sarah Park is the Hawaii State Epidemiologist and Chief of the Disease Outbreak Control Division. She directs all activities related to emerging infectious disease, surveillance and investigations, immunizations, and public health preparedness.
Hi, I'm Tim from the Democratic Party of Hawaii, and you're tuned to Hawaii Public Radio. Join the conversation on Twitter. Talk back to your radio at HI Conversation.
Today in the Backyard Quiz, we were thinking about a tree imported from to Hawaii from South America in 1900. Originally hailing from Brazil, this tree heralds the arrival of spring when its many lavender-colored flowers blossom. The tree can be found across Hawaii, but is especially prominent in upcountry Maui. It's believed that the trees found their way to the slopes of Haleakala when Portuguese farmers and ranchers settled in the area during the plantation years.
And we had a winner, As a matter of fact, we heard from Rick Kikta calling us from Kaneohe. This is a very, very popular quiz. There were lots of calls, including a percussionist from the Maui Chamber Orchestra, who you talked to a little while ago. Yes, thank you so much for calling us with the correct answer.
Which is the jacaranda tree.
That's right. Sorry about that.
In the late 50s, the Territorial Government's Highway Commission planted many of these trees along highways in Kula and Pukulani, where they can still be found, and they reach up to 50 feet in height. That's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000's Home Edition, an online tool designed for parents to strengthen the school-home connection by creating continuity between classwork and homework. Achieve3000.com.
And there are a lot of activities going on under the radar these days and every day at this time. And Morning Edition host and colleague Derek Malama joins us for a look at events going on in our community that might be a little under the radar. And there are free movies to be seen, Derek.
Yes, there are. On the Big Island, folks can see two free films tomorrow. The film The Roots of Ulu tells of native practitioners and agriculture experts who see the ulu, or breadfruit, playing a vital role in cultural preservation and food sustainability for Hawaii's future. And you'll also see an episode of The New Environmentalists. That's the Emmy Award-winning PBS series featuring portraits of passionate and dedicated activists. There's also a Q&A session with filmmaker John Antonelli, and that follows the screenings. And this takes place tomorrow at 7 p.m. at Volcano Arts Center's Ni'aulani campus. This presentation is free, but donations are welcome.
I've heard about this movie, Derek. That looks like a pretty good opportunity.
Oh, yeah.
And it's free, too.
Yes, that's an important part there.
Here's another free evening, a free evening filled with spiritual yoga sounds and music.
Yes, get ready to rock out to Kirtan, where you can't help but get up and dance, they say here. Have fun riding transcendental sound vibrations. Refreshments are also available for this one. It's from 7 to 9 p.m. on Friday. This is happening on Friday at the Atherton YMCA on University Avenue.
And we've also got a free concert in the park in Kona on Friday.
Yes, the West Hawaii County Band presents a free Friday concert every month. And the concert offers an hour of music selected for the band's extensive repertoire. And that includes traditional marches, classical music, film scores, and Hawaiian favorites as well. So once again, this free concert in the park by the West Hawaii County Band is at 6:30 p.m. Friday in the Hale Halawai County Park, and it's free.
Derek, as always, you've thought of plenty of ways to keep us busy.
Oh, yes. And for free.
And for free.
Mm-hmm.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community that might be going on under the radar. You can always find out more on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Aloha, this is Joey Manahan. If you want to listen back to a show, visit the conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org.
This week in This American Life,
there's this thing that's been bugging me. And every time I tell people about it, they just laugh.
One of our producers, David Kestenbaum, is really worried about this thing, an epic question. And the only person who can help him figure it out is one of his old physics professors.
Like, just think about it for real. Like, for real. Like, it's because it might be true.
We get to the bottom of it this week.
Hear This American Life, Saturday at 1 p.m.
What makes a sin deadly? Envy, I think, is my favorite sin. There's something so imaginative about it.
Pride leads to a lot of problems.
Greed is being a sociopath.
But with lust, who doesn't feel lust for life? And how can we tell someone not to feel lust?
I'm Guy Raz. The 7 Deadly Sins. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Saturday afternoon at 3.
At the door in the middle of the night. 3 men in the military uniform, the KGB major, handed me warrant for my arrest.
Join us for stories of Soviet interrogations, community builders, and Arctic explorers. That's next time on the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Saturday at 2 p.m. following This American Life.
Pianist Sarah Cahill has made a career out of celebrating the work of contemporary classical composers, opening her audience's ears to the music of Terry Riley, John Adams, Yoko Ono, and others. She'll be performing this weekend on Maui as part of a varied multimedia show from Ebb and Flow Arts. And Robert Pollock, who is the originator of Ebb and Flow Arts, is on the phone to tell us about it. Hi, Robert. Thanks for talking with us.
Hi, Chris. Can you hear me?
I can hear you just fine. Thanks, Robert.
Okay, great.
You know,
the
piano performance that is part of this show, and it's only part of the show, but it focuses on an interesting composer, Lou Harrison. What can you tell me about Lou Harrison?
Oh. Well, it so happens that Lou Harrison would have been 100 years old this past Sunday, May 14th. And there are many celebrations worldwide around this centenary. He was one of the first to adopt world music, that is to incorporate gamelans and pentatonic scales from Asia and so forth and mix them with Western instruments. He was also a pioneer of the percussion ensemble.
Mm-hmm.
He was basically a West Coast composer, lived in Northern California for most of the second half of his life. And when he, for example, with the percussion instruments, he and John Cage teamed up in the 40s, and they just gathered all sorts of found objects, pizza cans and garbage tops big water tubs and whatever, and put together these ensemble pieces that really began a whole genre. You find now percussion ensembles in every university and a huge amount of music written for them.
Well, you know, one of the things that happens when that happens, Robert, is you're instantly you're in the area of what might be called noises, or at least notes that are in between the keys of the piano.
I think percussionists would be offended by that because they think of their, you know, non-pitched sounds as able to make melodies and so on. But I know what you mean, yeah.
Yeah, I'm happy to use the term non-pitched sounds or you know, our microtones. But you know what I'm saying. It's not... This is getting away from Western tonality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it was very exploratory and innovative at the time, but as I say, it became just part and parcel of the 20th century music, as opposed to 18th, 19th century, where you had a timpani part that struck a note and then 58 measures rest and then struck another note. And
yeah.
maybe an occasional cymbal or so. I'm like, no, this is the percussion in full glory. And not only that, but he was an advocate of just intonation, so-called, you know, by the natural intonation, natural harmonics, and very much rejected European thought and development after World War II. He was appalled that after World War II, Europe didn't reach out. Rather, it turned inward. And he called it kind of the bottom-of-the-barrel intellectual activity. So he turned east to Asia and studied carefully many pentatonic scales and other things that he incorporated into his music.
Well, yeah, I just learned this recently, Robert, that a gamelan is in tune with itself, but it's not in the same, you know, it's not trying to accommodate Western pitches, that a gamelan is a self-contained unit where the instruments are attuned to one another, right?
That's right. That's right. Natural tuning. The other thing about Lou Harrison, and you'll hear it in these piano pieces that Sarah Cahill will perform on Saturday, is that he also used forms from the Renaissance, such as the so-called estampi that he labeled stampede, and music from the Baroque, classical music. He was a great student of Mozart, for example, at the suggestion of Arnold Schoenberg, and he then delved into the natural tuning, the Asian scale. So it's an amazing amount of influence that somehow he is able to make into coherent and actually wonderful pieces. And he wrote hundreds and hundreds of pieces, very prolific.
Well, you know, it's really a journey for our ears, and I know that's what you're all about with Ebb and Flow Arts, Robert. And I thank you very much for taking the time. I appreciate it. Sarah Cahill, pianist, will perform a piano concert in a program that also includes a 3D film presentation at the Maui Arts and Cultural Center's Iao Theater. It's an Ebb and Flow Arts presentation, and that was founder Robert Pollock we just spoke to.
And that's going to do it for us for today. Up tomorrow on Town Square, we're going to talk about the need for simultaneous therapies that address both substance abuse and mental health.
You can call our talkback line at 808-792-8217.
You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. And if you go to our website, which is on hawaiipublicradio.org, you will find more information about today's guests and topics, and you can also listen back to the program.
I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. I'll see you tomorrow for Town Square.